Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the African Knowledge Beyond the Book Club with your host, Charles, Brother Charles, and I'm joined by my lovely wife, Jolivet. Say hello, Jolivet.
Hello, Jolivet.
All right.
How are you tonight?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. It's been interesting reading a lot about this, the featured book, Confessions of Ned Turner, edited by Thomas R. Gray. Back in 1831. There are so many interesting dissertations and books written analyzing various facets of this case.
Right.
It is awesome. And the first case we're going to look at, which is in the first paragraph of the confession. I'll read it. It says, agreeable to his own appointment, on the evening he was committed to prison, with permission of the jailer, I visited Nat. He has the name Nat spelled in all caps. And he gives a date and so forth. And matter of fact, the first one of the first essays I read about it was regarding the name and appearance of Nathaniel Turner. Interesting enough, you when you scheduled the registered description, you wrote out Nathaniel Turner.
Right.
And I didn't think anything of it. You know, I just like scratched me like, that's interesting. I'd never seen a name written out complete like that.
Right.
And I just like, and I've talked a lot about names and the power of naming and the domination and everything, but I had not given much thought other than my parents used to talk about disrespect and incomplete names or things like that, which, you know, we do a lot of abridgment of names in our culture, later 20th century, we do that all the time. We always try to shorten the name.
Right.
So in our day, it's not a big deal.
But for me, I think that is exactly, of course, why I did that, to honor him by speaking his name, his given name, as it were. But I think that it is a big deal for some. In particular, I don't like, having my name abbreviated, especially by someone taking that type of liberty, and I have not given that permission, to do so. I don't particularly care for it. But it's like you said, I think it's very much cultural. And nowadays, respect is not really something that is, held in as high esteem as it was, when we were younger. But that is exactly the reason why, when I speak of him, if I include Nat, I put it, in the middle, and with the quotation marks and that kind of thing, because just to honor him by calling him by his name. Nat seems like a young boy or something.
Yeah, that could be inferred, right? But the right, yes, that is exactly. Well, not so much the little boy thing, but according to a lot of things I've written in the 19th century, the abbreviated name was only given to Negroes.
Okay.
It did not abbreviate a white man's name. And these are things that I didn't know about cult. This is 19th century. Styles or fashions or modes of etiquette. You know what I'm saying? That today we may not. I'm not saying maybe in another strata of society. People who have a different socioeconomic level still follow those conventions, which you are keenly aware.
Right.
However, I am not. For some reason, but like you said, people don't know you very well, taking that liberty to abbreviate a name. And this guy Kenneth Greenfield, he edited the compilation of essays, which I posted in the event page for people too. They probably can find it. I'm sure I found a local library, so I found my copy.
Right.
I didn't go out and purchase one, he talked about all Negroes were given one name. They didn't even usually have a surname. See, the name was abridged in some way, or it was they were given a nickname. We were given a nickname, and which is interesting about this case was that they gave him a surname in the trial. They called him Nat, alias Nat Turner. That's in the introduction of this book concerning him, and it's discussed a little bit, probably by other authors, but Greenfield discusses it at length. But the idea of making him an alias is by saying really that this ain't the name he's really known by. He's not known amongst the community as Nat Turner.
Right.
Now, maybe, you know, not to say he never used it, you know what I'm saying? It wasn't commonly understood. Now, Turner was supposed to be the white planter captive, who held his family in bondage. And one of the interesting features about this is that Nat was described as being in the wanted posters. He was there were very detailed descriptions about scars on his body and how tall he is, or you know, whatever. He was between 5'6" and 5'8", you know. And they described him as a light complexioned guy.
Okay.
Yeah, he was a light skinned brother. And then they had to put he said bright skin or bright complexion, but not a mulatto.
Okay.
Why he had to say he's not a mulatto? Because he was a mulatto.
Right.
Just like Frederick Douglass was, just like Booker Washington was, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Right, because the man who held his family, I forget his name, I don't remember it. The guy who was his father / captive, you know, that he was a highly regarded white man in that town, planter or whatever, and you know, they had this rule going that they didn't want to be implicated in adultery or raping the women on their plantation, so they would all, you know, I think Harriet Jackson talked about it in her book mentioning the name of her father and he being a white man, that was to be an insult to them. Oh, no, because you're supposed to pretend like they were better than they are, right? And that was the unspoken rapist rule when they tell the black, you know, tell our mothers and aunts and sisters when they rape us, that we are to not disclose their identity. We're supposed to be like the Scarlet. We're supposed to participate in the conspiracy.
Right, to conceal what they've done, their dastardly deeds. Right.
Right, and so you know, like Nathaniel Hawthorne, Scarlet Letter didn't give us a clue into their mind.
Right.
That this is exactly the kind of people that they are, and that this is what they do on a continuous basis. Not an anomaly to that particular novel, but yet is a reflection of their mentality.
Right.
And so he was discharacterized as a darker complexioned person after the trial. After everything was said and done, he was murdered by the colonial regime, and his body was desecrated. They severed his head among all the other men. They impaled the heads of all of the soldiers,
right,
who participated in this freedom expedition, and they named the place Blackhead Signpost or something. That was the name of it. And the interesting thing is that the ancient Sumerians and the Akkadians called themselves black-headed people.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I look at drawings and whatever, they try to depict them as white men.
Imagine that.
But they still know what black-headed meant by the 19th century, to be people who have black faces and, you know, black heads. And the head is not just the hair.
Right.
Right. So, you know, I just thought I'd throw that tidbit out there for any
question before you get further into the account. I have had several people to make the comment that there was never any confession, that the entire account is contrived.
I don't know. What's the basis for that?
I don't know. They just said that he never confessed. He never confessed to anything. He just went to his death without ever having told a story.
Well, all the historians, even James McGee, who's a historian in Southampton County, Virginia, still alive. He doesn't even make that kind of claim. So I don't know where they're based at.
Right.
That accusation from. I'm not saying, I'm not even, but there are lots of papers about it. Of course, there's some redaction done to his interview. It's an interview, really.
Right.
It's not really an interview. Okay, you don't want to call it a confession, call it an interview, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
You know?
And, well, one of the things that I thought was that it was very important that this particular rebellion, I think more so than some of the others, was very much downplayed. I think that there was a very different fear, with this particular rebellion than with others. And when you read about them, this one is colored slightly differently. We see more fear.
What really colors it, is, I think, in my opinion, is that you have the interview with Nat that preserved the memory of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only difference. All the other, they were bigger.
Right.
Now, the biggest one was here in Louisiana, which I haven't even studied that one yet. But there were bigger ones. Denmark Vesey had a big one planned. This is really was a small, poorly organized insurrection or bid for freedom that did more psychological harm to their enemies than the other ones did.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was well executed, it was small, fewer casualties. It only got like 60 people,
Right.
It was only like doing it for like a few days. It was really small potatoes. But it was big potatoes in terms of the psychological security of the oppressive regime called Virginia. That's where we're hitting. So they went through all of these, of course, their usual oppressive measures of beheadings and hangings and physical. They parted out his body and they made like purses out of Nathaniel Turner's skin. They've done all kinds of things. We know they cut off body parts and they pass them around as mementos to one another. This is very macabre, sadistic culture that calls itself America, God fearing and freedom. We don't know. They obviously feel some other kind of God.
And that, I think that's a very key point too. And I put that on the lead-in for the link to this particular show. I asked the question, why is it that this particular rebellion, it is never explained that Nat got much of his motivation from the words that these people claimed to believe in from the Bible? And then I asked the question, why is it now that the black churches who claim to be teaching from the same Bible aren't teaching so that there are others who will get this same kind of spirit, this same kind of understanding, and holding these people accountable using that document, as he did? And that is what I think was different, because I think that the Caucasian was going to use the Bible the way that they had to justify their wrongdoing. And when this man had taken that very same group of writings, those documents, and said, no, here is the cost that should be paid for what it is that you are doing, I think that is, had that gone out and spread, I think that it would have, really, disheveled way more than maybe they could have recouped had, the people gotten that kind of fervor, behind them. Because even Frederick Douglass talks about, the Christian church and how the Christian overseers, in particular the women of the slave masters, were the worst. It was one account where there was one woman that was nice to him, and then once she, was instructed otherwise, by the indoctrination, misrepresentation of, you know, her Christian what have you, then she became, you know, increasingly harsh with them and inhumane.
Yes, that's all true. You're right. Was the Gabriel conspiracy, Van Denmark Vesey's conspiracy, all of them drew from the scriptures, from the Hebrew, right, from Moses and the prophets.
Right.
That was the unifying thread. Harriet Jacobs discusses in that term brilliant in the aftermath of it in chapter 12 of her book, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. And in chapter 13, she discusses the church and slavery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we'll be looking at Harriet and Ancient Mother Harriet Jacobs and her take on the aftermath of this insurrection in Virginia and in her neck of the woods, in her county where she was living. So yeah, we're gonna cover all that, which is good. Is to look at that one particular writer in this essay. He discussed how the Christianity of the slave at that particular time was not what slave Christianity would become once the European decided they needed to control it.
Mm-hmm.
See, at this particular point, we're talking about 1831. It had just become illegal for a Negro to read, to be taught to read.
Mm-hmm.
We were reading the Bible for ourselves, and we were making our own interpretations. So Gabriel Van Denmark Vesey, they were having their meeting. They were discussing biblical mandates for manhood and struggle for liberty. You know, and fulfilling their social obligations and debating whether they should wait on a sign from God or they should take their action to perform their godly duty. This was the rhetoric. This is the discourse that was being done by people who were being held captive. And they weren't going to seminaries.
Right.
They weren't members of any lodges of any kind.
Right.
No Prince Hall, no any other kind of lodge. Instructing them on how to hermeneutics, okay, interpretation, and oh, we're going to look at it this way, and this is the proper way, and the other way is radical, and that's crazy. No, these people were on plantations working every day. They could read and write, and they could read and write better than people today.
Yeah, and that is so true. We talked about that before. We're looking at Frederick Douglass's work and his writing. Capabilities and skills, and it was just amazing. It was astounding to me, really.
Yeah, he can read and write. He's talking about his comprehension.
And these people were forbid, you know, to do that, and just looking at their comprehension and their ability to articulate themselves under those circumstances, it was amazing. It's amazing to me.
Right. These people had no formal education, as we know, which helps us understand that when we are formally educated in an oppressive society, when formal means educated by your oppressor, that means they can build into you the hermeneutics. They're shaping the way you see what you read.
Right.
These people weren't, our ancestors weren't being shaped in this way at this particular time in history. They weren't being molded in how to read it and what they should see and what they can't see, what they're going to be blind to when they open up the scriptures. They don't have that problem. You know? And today, you see a reactionary movement to say, oh, the scriptures are invalid because the European used the Bible to enslave us. But you know what? The Bible wasn't effective in enslaving the people who we're talking about tonight. You see what I'm saying?
Right. The Bible was used to chop off heads. I understand what you're saying.
Hey, it didn't work for that for these folks because these people didn't get that kind of miseducation.
Right. That's interesting.
Right.
Okay. And then another part that we need to, whenever we get into it, is I want to talk about how you know, the problem with the mother being advised of the plan. And essentially turning in Mr. Turner and that whole thing. And we see that repeated in more than one account. And so I'm eager to talk about that.
Well, I read about that in Ferdows, and I don't think I got that far in that to find out how a woman was used to disclose Nat's location. Saying yeah. Turner location. You had obviously a bit further ahead than I have.
Yeah, I have. Okay, I'm sorry. We're not going to get that far yet.
Okay.
Well, go ahead. You can start. I'm sorry.
Matter of fact, there is an essay in this other book, In Search of Nat Turner, about titles. Nat, who's this interview with? Oh my goodness, I can't find it. I'll find it in the table of contents. It's called, I think it's, let's see, what is it called? The Female Slave in the Nat Turner Slave Insurrection. So, it's supposed to be, I think it's supposed to be an examination of a key female figure in this drama. But we will look at, these are the different perspectives. Now I'm reading these essays and I'm looking at, you know, different ways of examining this interview termed, you know, titled The Confession. So that we can learn as much as we can at the, you know, present time to make this a more fulfilling experience.
Right.
Not just read the just read it and, you know, oh yeah, and just talk about, you know, what our 20th century sensibilities can ascertain, but just kind of, you know, look at what, you know, with a lot of the good things that have been said that are available to us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I wish somebody could find that one John Henry Clark edited, and what it was in response to a novel, but I'm sure there'd be some great insights to contribute to this discussion. This Thomas Gray, he appeared to ask, you know, interview the great Nathaniel Turner about his how he, you know, undertook this idea, and he asked him, you know, his origins and how he felt that, you know, he had these extraordinary abilities and whatnot, and that was what some people would say, he was a self-styled prophet, but aren't all prophets self-styled? You know what I'm saying?
All right.
They may come in a tradition of prophecy, but largely they are not highly regarded. In many cases, if they're not part of an ecclesiastical clergy class,
right?
You know, if they're from a peasant class, they have a harder time getting respect or recognition.
All right. We're coming up on a break. I want to welcome everybody in the chat room, those listening live on the browser, and thank you to our callers for coming in to join us this evening. This is the last few moments of the show, and so if you'd like to hear the remaining broadcast, you'll need to call in at 323-580-5707. Otherwise, we will see you next Wednesday to talk about more of this same account. Again, the number is 323-580-5707. And we will be right back.
Listen in to African Conversations on the African Knowledge Network, where we will converse with researchers about matters significant to the African diaspora community. Join us on Facebook on the African Conversations community page. Enjoy the dialogue on African Conversations on blogtalkradio.com.
This
Listen to Love in Black with Charles and Jolivet on the Tribal Family Station on blogtalkradio.com.
There we will share our experiences and our insights on marriage and love, sex, respect, and honor. We're on every Thursday evening on the Tribal Family Station.
Greetings. My name is Eric Beamer, host of Common Sense Conversation. Join me every Tuesday and Friday when I put common sense where it ain't so common. That's Common Sense Conversation every Tuesday and Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Pacific. Common Sense Conversation on blogtalkradio.com.
Join the Woman's Song Community Experience every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Central Standard Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on blogtalkradio.com. We will do the thing that many think cannot be done.
African Knowledge Beyond the Book appears every Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Central Standard Time. We are a literary society dedicated to the study of African-based psychoanalytical texts. We hope you will join us as we delve into the inner working of our African consciousness. African Knowledge Beyond the Book, every Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Central Standard Time on blogtalkradio.com.
Welcome to AfricanImpressions.com. African Impressions is a black-owned business that offers products made by the global African community. African Impressions offers the finest in African-made jewelry, craft, clothing, and so much more. As the renaissance of the African community rapidly approaches, you need to add acquiring products crafted by members of the global African family to your repertoire of activities. We must rediscover more of our ancient cultural habits, which we struggle to regain, and incorporate them into our daily lives. Support African craftsmen and women by shopping at AfricanImpressions.com today. Hope to see you there.
All right, we're back. We're still continuing. We're in overtime, working on discussing our feature, The Confessions of Nat Turner by Thomas R. Gray, published in 1831, part of the Slave Narratives Collection, published by Library of America and edited by William A. Andrews and Henry Louis Gates. And we were just discussing before the break how this whole concept of this alleged confession, which was actually an interview edited by a lawyer who was in the Southampton County, Virginia, and how this publication of words from this. Matter, this is the only that I know of. If anybody knows one, please, you can share it on the event page. Of any successful African revolt, military, and response to European oppression of black people, than any interview with that individual prior to or following the end of the battle. And this particular now we know this seared and aside from, you know, folk legends in Virginia of Nathaniel Turner. But apart from that, if you didn't know anybody in Southampton, Virginia, you may have read this book or some other analysis regarding this book and the incidents. Someone who may have analyzed the court records, the transcripts from the trial, in addition to this publication. This is a hallmark, this particular writing right here. This is a hallmark in the slave narrative genre, because we have an actual transcript of a conversation, an interview with the revolutionary, the leader of the revolution, following its conclusion. And that's what makes this particular piece of literature so precious, and is one that has been studied in and out. And his character assassination continues in the obliteration of his memory, or the desecration of his memory, has been under attack by those who attack us and persecute us and haunt us day and night in this land of freedom for some and living hell and punishment for others, and others are us. But anyway, this particular situation of studying the scriptures, giving them a proper reading, and as it actually was like a guidepost, a philosophical basis to help us think our way through our condition, and in turn develop an appropriate response to it. Now, Jalavet, you mentioned earlier before the break how inappropriate reading, which was developed through a dis or miseducation, led to a system of improper interpretation. So where you have Bibles everywhere, we have Hebrew, we got Aramaic, we got Amharic, we have sources, we got Greek, we got black scholars that can do all these languages, and they can't even read it in the same context as these ancient people could a couple hundred years ago.
Correct.
They can't read it that good. They still read it with the matter of fact, this one essay I'm reading is titled "Reading Revelation and Rebellion." No, not that one. That's another one. That's one. The Prophet in His Own Land. That's the one. And it's by I think this guy named is Breed, and he talks about religious. Yeah, Patrick H. Breen, that's his name. Patrick Breen. This is called "The Prophet in His Own Land: Subtitle Support for Nat Turner and His Rebellion Within Southampton's Black Community." And he's talking about in this analysis about how there was no unified theology, or so no unified slave Christianity, and that it was the people, you know, our people. They studied and they read and they developed. They were basically free. They were free to think, and free to understand. And the people who in their communities, matter of fact, I'm gonna tell you this. I'm reading this one analysis. They were talking about Nat Turner was considered an Uncle Tom. You understand what I'm saying? These are white analysts reading. Because Nat had escaped from the plantation at one point. He came back on his own.
Really?
Yeah, he said he heard a voice telling him that he should go back and, you know, he's got this from the Gospel of Luke, for he who knows his master's will does it and will be beaten many stripes. And so he, Nat took that to mean that he was in bondage with his people. See, this is not the way the white man preaching the pulpit as, you know, do your master and take all the beatings I give you and learn to like it. No, Nat didn't read it that way. Nat read it and was like, well, I'm escaping from myself. He was looking at it in terms of the ego versus the collective. I, the ego, the person, the individual, Nat Turner, I can run away, but my people are in bondage. Mm-hmm. I must be in bondage with my people. If I want to be free, I got to set my people free. That was his interpretation, you know, as how to deal with being on the plantation or not leaving the way he left. See what I'm saying?
Right.
And so he came back, so he had to develop a solution to his people's problems. And what I'm saying is that not that he wasn't autonomous, that when he came back and he was talking about, you know, he hadn't unveiled his plan to anybody about, you know, trying to throw off the chains of oppression, but identifying and just maintaining, I'm going to suffer with my brothers, my people. I'm not going to try to free myself.
Right.
We are going to be free together. We're going to be in bondage together. That was his point of view. And they were like, we need to do something else. They were more hot-headed. They were more militant. This is what I need to say. They were more militant than he was. And by today's standards, we can't even imagine that community. We can't. That's like, you know what I'm saying? When Nat Turner is the least militant.
Right. Right. I had to snap out of that for just a second. Exactly.
You know, because you remember, I read the files, you believe, you know, we read it some years ago, and it was talking about Nat, you know, he was attacking somebody with one of the weapons, and he wasn't successful at, you know, at finishing off the person, and somebody else had to do it. You know, these guys was like hardcore. These guys were real soldiers. Like in the first essay, they talked about, and they're dealing with name facing by the name facing by that term. Regarding names, I forget this. I would like to read that. It was one of these guys on the planters, whatever, and they ran into him on the plantation out in the field. And when they walked up on him, they called him by a nickname that they had just given him on the spot. I wish I could read that verbatim. They said, they walked up on the guy and they said, "What's up, Dick?" And the white man knew he was in trouble, you know, because he did not address him with all of the respect and the, you know, by pronouncing his name as Master this or whatever, all these titles of dignity of distinction.
Distinction, right?
Right. That the European man felt that was his right, and these brothers was walking towards him, and they called him out of his name.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it was like, uh-oh, something's afoot. And it was afoot.
All right, we got to get out of here.
But all right.
All right, see you next week.
Pete.
You know what? Oh, wait, I was going to say. Next week. Are you going to be, I mean, do you anticipate, you know, how much longer we're going to be, you know, in this particular book?
No, I can't, because I'm going through the confession part, I mean, the first page, and we're just analyzing as we go along. But I don't know. I'm trying to, you know.
Because I know it's short, and that's why I was asking.
Yeah, it's short, but I'm trying to, you know, get in there as much as I can, but I don't know.
Okay, I just wanted to be able to announce as soon as possible the next work so that anybody who may want to read ahead can. And, you know, feel free to contribute to the discussion, and we will see you next week. And until then, we will see you on the Facebook wall at facebook.com/AK Beyond the Book. Peace.
Peace.